Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Welcome back to the Obesity Medicine Association's podcast, Obesity, a Disease. I'm Dr. Allison Rhodes, an obesity medicine physician at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, your host for this ongoing series where we explore how obesity intersects with a wide variety of medical specialties. In this episode, we're taking a closer look at the connection between obesity and endocrinology. We are again joined by Dr. Megha Poddar, endocrinologist and obesity medicine specialist, who serves as the medical director of the Medical Weight Management Center of Canada. She's also assistant clinical professor at McMaster University. Welcome back, Dr. Poddar. I'd like to start our session today by diving in a little bit into the challenges that are unique to care of patients with obesity and endocrinology. When you're treating conditions like diabetes or thyroidal disease, what are some of the unique challenges you encounter in patients who also have obesity?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, right? Because people don't live in little boxes where one organ system is the only thing that's affected. When you have obesity, you tend to have multiple different complications of that disease state. So I think that some of the challenges we encounter with somebody, for example, who already has established diabetes, is that they do tend to have more complications and tend to respond less well to treatment. And we've actually seen that in the clinical trials. You know, when you take the same pharmacotherapy agent in somebody without without diabetes, they lose more weight than somebody who has diabetes. And so why is that? It's likely because once you have these established conditions like diabetes, you've probably had obesity for a long period of time. We know that once you're diagnosed with diabetes, you've probably had diabetes for at least 5 to 8 years before you actually got the diagnosis. So now you've had this pro-inflammatory condition in your body for so long without the diagnosis, and so you're seeing the downstream effects. What does this mean, and how does this translate to patient care? Is that these patients are more complicated. They will require more support. They need a thorough physical exam and a thorough assessment to see what else is going on. And then the counseling is really important because patients who are already in the healthcare system are certain types of people and personalities. They have a certain relationship with the healthcare system. And so what I mean by that is somebody with diabetes is probably already taking 3 medications. And so the idea that now I need to take something else, or there's this other issue or this other issue, there's fatigue and it's a burden of disease. And so unless we are explaining the root cause, the insulin resistance and the inflammation as a sort of journey for their metabolic health, it becomes an overwhelming situation when somebody already has these established diseases. So I think these patients are fundamentally different. They require more support. They require collaboration with multidisciplinary teams, as well as other specialists and primary care. But they also have the most impressive outcomes, right? Because if you're treating somebody with diabetes, then you're probably saving mortality more likely than somebody without diabetes. So when it comes to systems and policies, I think these patients are the ones that need to be triaged as severe and urgent because their outcomes will likely be better if they actually got treatment.
I'm glad you brought that up in terms of, you know, these patients, they certainly need a more focused lens looking at all the details involved in their care because there are so many different nuances. And like you said, the interplay between the different conditions, thinking about, again, this predominance of metabolic syndrome in patients with type 2 diabetes and making sure we're paying attention to risks for sleep apnea and hypertension. Looking at all this, and I certainly find this in my practice as well, when I'm looking at the medication list that's 20, maybe even 30 different medications long, how do you find that how patients that have these really long med lists that have obesity, how are you adjusting medications? Do you have sort of a philosophy or framework for how you think about when you're approaching a patient's medication list, How would you maybe adjust dosing, and what are some of the relationships that you look for to try to optimize things for your patients?
Yeah, so when I look at a medication list, I'm sort of putting things into three different buckets. The first bucket is going to be preventative. This medication is not going anywhere ever. That's where the statins and the aspirin, if you've got established cardiovascular disease, we're not going to get you off of those medications. We may need dose adjustment, but probably not touching those. The next bucket is going to be medications that are weight promoting, because there are lots of medications, whether it's insulin or TZDs or antipsychotics, lots of medications that actually cause weight gain. And if we can alter those and change those, then we have better outcomes for obesity treatment and metabolic syndrome. The last bucket is going to be the medications that are weight dependent. So these are our antihypertensives, where you can actually have a negative outcome if somebody is successful at reducing their weight and they become hypotensive because they're still on their antihypertensive. So this is where my strategy is around counseling the patient around symptoms of the outcome. So if it's hypotension, orthostatic hypotension, dizziness, checking your blood pressure at home, and then giving them thresholds to when to cut their medication in half or discontinue it. 10% is weight loss is kind of my marker. If somebody's reducing their weight by 10% on their next visit, I'm preemptively often reducing other medications depending on what their blood pressure, for example, was on that visit. So blood pressure is a big one. Diabetes medications that cause hypoglycemia. So if they're on a sulfonylurea, if they're on insulin, then I'm going to be proactive about adjusting those as their weight is going down. And then the thyroid medication is one that's often forgotten, because when you dose thyroid hormone replacement for somebody who has hypothyroidism, it's actually a weight-based dose. So as they're losing weight, people often think, the obesity treatment's interacting with my thyroid hormone, but it's actually not such. It's just that your weight is going down, so you need less thyroid hormone externally. So I tend to do a TSH for anyone that's on thyroid hormone replacement every 6 months if they're on obesity treatment, because as their weight is going down, they typically need less. So those are some of the nuances that I look at from a medication history.
Sounds like we have similar practices. I definitely calculate that 10% weight loss goal for all my patients after each visit, because you're right, I might not see them for 6 months, especially if they're doing really well and they don't need, sooner follow-up, or, maybe they're following regularly with other providers. So I love that idea of anticipatory guidance and, creating that partnership with patients. Do you find that patients with obesity face either more frequent or more severe complications over time? And what are some of the most common things that you're seeing in your patients?
Yeah, I do think those living with obesity are going to naturally have more negative outcomes of the obesity if the obesity has not been addressed before. I'm seeing a lot of fatty liver and MASLD. It's kind of everywhere. It's underdiagnosed. Anyone with diabetes really should be screened. Anyone with obesity should be screened. I'm diagnosing a lot of that. I'm also seeing a lot of challenges with fertility. As I mentioned, a lot of patients are coming to me, unfortunately, after the fact, where they're participating in fertility treatments, but they're being suggested to have their obesity treatment in order treated in order for their fertility treatments to be successful. Knee replacements, hip replacements. There's a lot of other health conditions that are being that the obesity is a barrier for. Transplant patients. Patients can't get transplanted. You can't get IVF. You can't, there's all these kind of limitations in the healthcare system because of the obesity itself. So I have a type of practice where I end up kind of getting that demographic of patients where it's almost nice because they've got a clear end goal. It's like this other health condition that they need to get to. But, it does make patients a little bit more complicated. The other thing we haven't really talked about, we talked a lot about metabolic syndrome, but we didn't talk about malignancy. So that's a really underdiagnosed phenomenon. Obesity is pro-inflammatory. It also causes malignancy at higher rates. To your point about primary care, people with obesity don't actually interact with the healthcare system as often because of stigma and bias and shame. And so they're not getting screened. They don't get the typical mammograms, and they're not getting, the colonoscopies. So all of these cancer screening things in the general population, a higher risk patient population in obesity is actually not getting screened, and treatments are not as effective. So you can just imagine at every kind of layer, we're not doing well with malignancy and obesity. And a lot of our treatments, specifically bariatric surgery, has actually been shown to improve malignancy outcomes. So it's one of these phenomenon where we've seen the direct outcome, we've seen the problem with not treating, and then we've seen what happens when you do treat. We have evidence to support each of those things.
I couldn't agree more in terms of talking to patients about the numerous ways in which they can improve their health. You know, not only just the things they can see right in front of them, reduce knee pain, better mobility, better manage blood sugars, but also even those things that maybe they don't necessarily want to think about ahead, but just sort of what is exactly, as you said in our prior episode, you know, what did they envision for that future life? And I think most of us envision, I mean, despite the fact that you and I both work in healthcare systems, I envision my life far away from a hospital and far away from doctor's offices,
right,
unless I'm
right.
there for work. And I think most people feel that way. So that is certainly something that I think as obesity medicine clinicians, we don't always put at the forefront of our, you know, initial treatment plan, or even those, you know, first, like maybe 1 or 2 years of follow-up visits. But I think it is really important to think about how do we rope this into the conversation with patients in terms of thinking about some of these long-term impacts. And maybe once a patient is at a weight where they feel more comfortable going in for a pap smear or more comfortable getting that mammogram, you know, how can we play a role for them in terms of helping support their primary care doctors to making sure that they're getting those screenings as we've helped reduce their risk by helping them with managing their obesity. As we talk about managing obesity, I think that we would be completely remiss if we were not to talk about our newest therapies, the GLP-1 receptor agonists. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of attention, not only in the medical community, but among our social media and really, honestly, any type of media these days. How do you feel like the advent of GLP-1 receptor agonists have changed the way that endocrinologists approach obesity and obesity-related conditions?
I think, you know, I've been in this space for about 10 years. So I was there before the GLP-1 or just when liraglutide, Saxenda was first kind of being brought onto the market. So I saw what it was like to treat obesity without effective treatment. And I'm saying that in a way because we know that for most people, behavior change alone is not powerful enough to decrease that pro-inflammatory state, right? So biology sort of lends itself to, just like other chronic diseases, needing something more powerful to overcome biology. So I saw how hard it was to see people try day in and day out. And really, we weren't very successful because it wasn't effective treatment. So you can imagine trying to convince a very busy endocrinologist who is treating all these different things to work on behavior change, which at the end of the day, we knew wasn't actually going to improve health outcomes. And then all of a sudden, you know, we had a treatment. Now, liraglutide and GLP-1 was an introduction. So it was sort of this phenomenon where we were having to convince patients, you know, and their idea was what an injection and what I have to be on it forever and a medication for weight management. Like none of those things were sort of, they weren't aware of any of those things. So for a good, I would say 3 years, it was like really trying to get people to be convinced that this is a medication and obesity is a disease. And then COVID hit, which I think was an interesting sort of turn in the obesity landscape, where the number one risk factor for poor outcomes in COVID was actually obesity. And so now health systems and the government and everyone was sort of starting to become more aware of the poor prognosis of all these patients that weren't having any discussion about obesity. And then all the other GLP-1s, semaglutide and now tirzepatide, really started to be one, more effective, two, easier to use weekly instead of daily. And then three, obesity was so much more prominent in the conversation. So I think that lended itself to then an explosion of Hollywood and lots of other kind of conversations around weight loss. Whereas we're here talking about something different. We're talking about obesity treatment, which is improving the adipose tissue inflammation in the body to have a better health outcome for our patients. Whereas some of the other conversations are about weight loss. And so that's kind of the distinction between these two therapies. And never before have we had treatment that was effective for obesity other than bariatric surgery until we had pharmacotherapy, and the GLP-1s were the only ones that were effective enough to improve health outcomes. And so, you know, why didn't we see improvement in cardiovascular disease with any other medication? Because it wasn't effective enough. It wasn't lowering weight enough. It wasn't improving the inflammation, and it wasn't keeping the weight off. And so until we had that outcome, we weren't able to have that overall success with treatment. And so I think the narrative has really shifted, but we're still in this world where weight loss, the more you lose, the better the drug, you know, that kind of conversation is still at the forefront. So the onus is on us when we have these conversations with our patients to help kind of reframe what success looks like. And that's why I mentioned earlier in our last episode about the patient's goals, and not having it be how much are you going to weigh at the end of this, but like, what are you trying to do? And if we frame it that way, all of a sudden it's about obesity treatment and not about weight loss.
Your holistic thought process to this is truly something I hope our listeners take home, and that it's not about a number on the scale. It's about health goals, what you envision for yourself, and how you can, you know, really optimize your life, and how GLP-1s might fit into that picture, you know, depending on where you are in this continuum. You mentioned GLP-1s being an incredibly effective pharmacologic approach, and you also mentioned bariatric and metabolic surgery as a treatment modality. And we certainly know that we've seen a lot of improvement in metabolic related comorbidities for individuals that undergo bariatric and metabolic surgeries. You know, we see incredible remission even years later of type 2 diabetes. We see remission of sleep apnea, hypertension, metabolic syndrome. How do you feel like bariatric and metabolic surgeries fit into endocrinology care, especially in the advent of GLP-1 receptor agonist therapies?
I think bariatric surgery is always going to have a place in obesity treatment. It is still, like, as you mentioned, our most effective treatment for obesity-related complications, especially type 2 diabetes. You know, there was a great study that looked at bariatric surgery versus pharmacotherapy. And the reason that bariatric surgery tends to do better is not because pharmacotherapy is necessarily inferior or not as effective, especially our newer agents. We're seeing very much, you know, greater than 20% overall weight reduction, which is kind of similar to bariatric surgery weight reduction. But the challenge with pharmacotherapy is people don't stay on the medication. And so you're not going to get 5-10 year outcomes with pharmacotherapy as you would with bariatric surgery, because you just don't have the longevity of the treatment until we start to improve adherence and start a different discussion around, you know, maintenance on these pharmacotherapy agents. So I think that's where bariatric surgery shines. So a lot of the time, you know, if my patients are younger, they are low surgical risk, they have type 2 diabetes on insulin already, that's a phenomenal candidate for bariatric surgery, because they have so much to gain, very little risk. And they're, you know, that 25-year-old, when they turn 50, that 50-year-old is probably going to be in the best health that they possibly could have if they have the bariatric surgery, compared to starting a pharmacotherapy agent who may or may not have that same benefit. The only other thing I'll add is obesity is a chronic condition, right? So even after bariatric surgery, we're still using pharmacotherapy very often to maintain that weight or have avoid weight regain. So it's not a one and done situation, but how is that 50-year-old compared to that 25-year-old going to do? Very often, surgery plus pharmacotherapy, for example, is what is going to be needed.
I'm so glad you brought up that, you know, many of our patients acquire multiple modalities for treatment of this chronic disease. I find it particularly interesting, you know, the intersection between women's health, fertility, and all these different treatment options that we have now. You know, you brought up earlier in our prior episode, thinking about timing of when a GLP-1 would work for a patient, particularly a female who is desiring pregnancy. And I think this is something you highlighted when you were talking about that 25-year-old patient. You know, it might be much better to look into a highly effective procedure like a vertical sleeve or a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, you know, especially if a woman is anticipating pregnancy in, you know, the coming 5 to 10 years, getting their body in the best shape metabolically, not only to, you know, impact their health, but the health of future generations. And a medication may need to be added at a later point, you know, particularly to help with postpartum weight loss. But this certainly is a continuum and something where each of these tools can be used at a different point in a patient's life. Exactly, I feel like, as you've said, in terms of what their specific goals are and what their vision is for their life. So I'm glad to hear that you are talking to your patients about this, you know, full continuum. And I couldn't agree more that bariatric and metabolic surgery still are certainly powerful tools in our toolkit. As we both know, there are a lot of future medications in development that are going to hit our field. I certainly have time blocked off on my weekends, I feel like, for the next decade to make sure I'm reading and up to date and, you know, being the most educated prescriber of, you know, what I feel like are going to be dozens of medications that are going to hopefully become FDA approved and, you know, add to our toolkit. Are there any future developments that particularly excite you that are coming down in the pipeline?
I think it's all very exciting. I ultimately this space is growing rapidly. We're looking at things a little bit differently now. So, for example, you know, is all weight loss the same? So initially, we were just looking at percentage weight loss, and so whoever lost the most weight, you know, the triple agonist retatrutide is sort of the caveat one that people are all waiting for because it targets three different receptors and results in a higher percentage weight reduction that we've seen so far. But what I'm more interested in is the type of weight reduction. So there are certain medications now that are focused on muscle and preserving lean muscle as you're reducing weight. I find that very interesting. I find it very interesting that we're kind of using our knowledge about obesity as a chronic disease and looking at different phases of treatment. So whether acute treatment looks different from maintenance treatment, because we have an adherence problem. We can have all the amazing medications we want, but if nobody's on these long-term, it's futile. So how do we actually improve adherence? And maybe maintenance looks like a monthly injectable or a different mechanism of action. I find that very interesting. I also think that we're looking at technology to really enhance personalization. So this idea that obesity is a chronic disease, but then we're using GLP-1 plus something in every single pharmacotherapy actually doesn't, you know, fit the narrative. So why is it that, what do we do about all the people that are not responding to GLP-1? And so how do we start to personalize and individualize treatment? And that's where some of these technologies around laboratory assessments and different proteins, and can we start to personalize treatment and then target therapy to that? That's where I find things are getting very exciting, because it seemed almost unsolvable. But with the advent of GLP-1 plus understanding obesity better plus technology, you know, it just feels like anything is possible now, which is super exciting.
I couldn't agree more with you about the thought of different phases of treatment. I get excited looking at the different weight loss percentages that we're seeing with the different medications as they're in, you know, phase 3 trials, and thinking about where might these fit in for my patients. You know, if there's a lower average percentage weight loss, you know, maybe this is a perfect medication to fit in for my patient that's working on, you know, weight maintenance as opposed to that really robust weight loss. So I'm certainly excited about all the new tools and, exactly like you said, figuring out where they fit into a patient's journey over time and that individualization aspect and the customization. I feel like you've touched on this already, but having started in practice during COVID, I have felt the same sort of transition of, you know, obesity being this stigmatized, under, you know, sort of elephant in the room. We're not talking about it. We're not even necessarily talking about how it relates to health conditions, to now we've got, you know, one class of medications that's highly effective, but it's not that personalized, individualized approach necessarily. And, you know, I'm hoping over the coming decades, we're going to get to that level where we are able to individualize, customize, and improve access and adherence for our patients, and really be able to hopefully make this, you know, chronic disease something that people are able to live with comfortably and not have to necessarily have such the stigma and bias that people have experienced to date.
Totally.
Thank you again for joining us for this deeper dive into the evolving landscape of obesity-related endocrine disease. Today, we tackled some of the key challenges that providers face in diagnosis and long-term management, and we also looked ahead at some of the promising new treatments on the horizon. We're especially grateful to our guest, Dr. Podar, for bringing her perspective and expertise to this important conversation. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more insights in our upcoming episodes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Obesity, a Disease. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other valuable resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode and want to listen regularly, head over to iTunes where you can subscribe, rate, and leave us a much appreciated review. The views expressed in this episode are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please join us again for our next episode of Obesity, a Disease.